From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Amy Berg, the director of the documentary series The Case Against Adnan Syed. She uses new evidence to look at the story of a Baltimore teen convicted of killing his ex-girlfriend in 1999. And even if you binge the earlier podcast Serial, Berg says there's something in her series for you.
They say that true crime is kind of like an addiction. They say that you get like a release, like a roller coaster. The adrenaline rush is similar to that.
And drummer Antonio Sanchez prepares for the first live performance of his Trump-inspired album, Bad Hombre. All that on The Frame.
Podcasts are supported by Cohen Media Group, presenting the film Ash is Purest White. A loving girlfriend defends her gangster boyfriend in an act that sends her to prison. While she's in jail, her boyfriend moves on. Starts Friday at Limley Monica and Arclight Hollywood.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The Case Against Adnan Syed is a four-part documentary series on HBO, directed by Amy Berg. It picks up where the podcast Serial left off.
Adnan Syed's story has captivated millions since the 2014 launch of the podcast Serial.
The podcast was downloaded more than 100 million times,
turning the Syed case into a global sensation.
Syed was convicted of murdering his ex-girlfriend, Haemin Lee, 20 years ago, and has been serving a life sentence since 2000. And both Serial and the new HBO series explore the evidence and testimony that implicated him and could potentially exonerate him. But last Friday, Maryland's highest court, in a 4-3 ruling, decided that Syed is not entitled to a new trial. The case against Adnan Syed includes new investigations, and director Amy Berg also looks at the life of Haemin Lee.
I understand why Serial went the way it did. I mean, as a journalist, a filmmaker, a storyteller, trying to tackle an old murder case is so frustrating. And Serial, I think, was so intoxicating for so many people because it was like a behind the scenes of making a documentary. Just the ins and outs and who you were trying to speak with, who will talk to you, who won't talk to you, why, the police records, all of that kind of journey was so kind of frustrating for me as a listener. But I still wanted to see the visual story. And I think you get so much by seeing people's faces and expressions when they're retelling these stories.
So when you think about ways in which you can tell this story visually, because Serial was obviously a podcast, you have to go back and talk to people, and some of those people may have been a part of Serial, but there's also people that you bring in that haven't been a part of it. And then you work with things like Haemin Lee's diaries. So when you are thinking about the visual look of this documentary, what were the most important things for you to get and to represent?
Well, first of all, in true crime stories, oftentimes the victim gets lost in the storytelling. In this case, that's happened quite a bit because there's such an online debate of whether he did it or didn't do it. So for me, after reading Hayes' journals, I really wanted to bring her back to life.
April 30th, 1998. I have to write right now so I can tell about the game. We won. Dundalk was burning with rage. I scored 3 at the beginning and Isha scored 2. What a great way to end the season.
And I had just seen the film Diary of a Teenage Girl. This was about 3.5 years ago or so. And I was blown away by the animations in that film. So I contacted the animator and we collaborated on creating this beautiful storyline for Haemin Lee. And I wanted to really make sure you understood that she was just a teenage girl. She was a high schooler, as was most of the people that were affected by this case. And so that's what the first episode is really all about. It's about the world of Woodlawn High School.
Me and Hay played field hockey together. That's when we became friends.
She was just so light and bubbly, and it was really hard to be in a bad mood around her. But if I had
one of the things that I think can happen, and this is a complaint I had with Serial, is that as you're focusing on the crime, you lose the focus of the victim. And it seems to be that you want to make sure that this is a story not only about an investigation, but about the life that was lost. So how do you go about putting together Haemin Lee's life, what she was like, what her life was like, and what she meant to her friends and family?
I mean, Haemin Lee was a superstar. She was an athlete. She was an academic. She had a whole life ahead of her. She had big dreams. She was a good artist. She was going to go to college. She had plans. And everyone who spoke about her as this bright light. And I just wanted to make sure that she stayed alive throughout the film. I mean, this film starts with her and it ends with her. And one thing that one of her best friends said to me was that if justice was not served in this case, Hay would have been the first one to want to make sure that the right person is actually in prison for this case. And there are so many questions that I feel like, you know, her voice would push us through in many ways.
Was it an issue for you that people who thought they had told their story were done telling their story and they didn't want to revisit what they'd said? Were there any obstacles in interviewing people because of what had happened before?
Well, I think it actually was more productive than you would think, because the people that spoke to Sarah Koenig and participated in Serial, just like when they testified in the first trial, didn't know the rest of the ingredients to the story. So when you put things together, you can really fill it in nicely. And after Serial, there was this kind of armchair sleuth community on Reddit that started pulling documents out and really kind of putting things together. So it really painted a different picture.
Prosecutors are not normal attorneys. Their job is not just to their case or to their client. Their job is to do justice. And they don't have an incentive to see that part of their job done, so they fall back into attorney mode, where winning is the only goal.
Who is Susan Simpson, and what is her take on the case, and why is it important to you?
Susan Simpson came out of the Reddit culture. She was a blogger who did a 35-page blog after Serial and was discovered by Rabia Chowdhury, who is an advocate for the family. Susan, when looking at the cell phone records, discovered a fax cover sheet that basically discredited the entire state's case. This fax cover sheet specifically says that incoming calls cannot be relied upon, yet the state failed to give that to their expert, and they used the incoming calls to tell their whole story. So it became like part of what happened after Serial was Adnan's case post-Serial, and that's really where our current-day timeline starts in the film.
One of the things that you do in this documentary, and it goes back to the beginning of 2016, is you hire private investigators who are going to do their own research into this. So why did you decide that was important, and what does that give you as a storyteller in terms of a fresh look at the facts?
In Baltimore, there is kind of a code of silence in terms of access to police detectives, documents, the case file. It was really
about all cases or this case in particular?
I think it's about all cases.
Okay.
They have some very strict laws there about no cameras in the courtroom. They're still very archaic in terms of what they allow the public to know. And so I had access to some private attorneys who I actually met through Barry Scheck at the Innocence Project. And they had a lot of inroads in Maryland that I never would have had. And they were looking at it in a professional way, as they do on any case. And I wanted to work with people that could help us to tell this story.
Coming up, more with director Amy Berg and her documentary series, The Case Against Adnan Syed.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Cohen Media Group, presenting the new film, Ash is Purest White, official selection Cannes Film Festival, a sprawling drama that follows a young woman sent to jail after firing a gun to protect her gangster boyfriend in a fight with his rivals. Upon her release, she tries to pick up where they left off, only to find that her boyfriend has moved on. Starts Friday at the Limley, Monica, and Arclight Hollywood.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. After Adnan Syed was found guilty of murdering his high school ex-girlfriend, his legal advocate, Rabia Chowdhury, took his case to journalist Sarah Koenig, hoping that she could bring attention to what Chowdhury thought was a wrongful conviction. Koenig went on to host and produce the Serial podcast, which cast doubt on Syed's guilt, and on two occasions, his conviction was overturned. But last Friday, his appeal for a new trial was denied. I spoke with Amy Berg, the director of The Case Against Adnan Syed, before last week's court decision. Let's return to my conversation with her.
They say that true crime is kind of like an addiction. They say that you get like a release, like a roller coaster. The adrenaline rush is similar to that. This story is very personal. And I can't think of another true crime story where you're in the house with a Muslim family, where you're dealing with a group of high school students that are really kind of trying to find out what actually happened with their friends. And it's a really exciting case for a lot of different reasons. And I think that the show is very emotional, and I think that it will be satisfying to the audience. I think it's really powerful. This story is, you know, endemic of the American dream, I guess, in a lot of ways, gone wrong.
Well, and that gets back to the bigger idea of what this documentary series is all about, and that is the way our judicial and justice system is set up. Mm-hmm. We'd rather have a guilty person go free than convict somebody who is innocent. Mm-hmm. And yet that concept seems to be really challenged in the telling of this story.
Well, yeah, I mean, because we have four parts and it's over 4 hours, we have the luxury of being able to really go deep on a lot of different things. I mean, there is evidence in this case. There's forensics evidence, there are fingerprints, there are a lot of things that we were able to kind of tap into. So I think it's important to, you know, stick with it for all four episodes.
You hire, or your investigators hire, people like turf specialists to look at how grass may or may not grow under a car that's parked there for a long time. You talk to a surveyor about where Heyman Lee's body was found. Mm-hmm. Were all these things, in your mind, going to have some eureka moment, or were they all going to add up? Were you disappointed when it didn't quite change the course of history?
God, there's so many rabbit holes in this story. you're reminding me of all these moments where we thought we solved the case. When I finished the Serial podcast, I did not believe anything that Jay said, but I had no idea how he knew where the car was.
Jay was a classmate of Anand's, and Jay is the one who told the story that convicted Anand. At trial, he said that Anand killed Hay in the parking lot of Best Buy, and then he also said that he helped Anand bury her in Lincoln Park. The thing is that the story that Jay told at trial is actually not the same story that he told the police the first time.
And so the first thing I did was I called Steve Drizin and Lauren Ryder at the Northwestern Center for False Confessions, and I had them look at Jay's statements, all of them. They found that every single statement of his was contaminated except for the car statement. They couldn't find any contamination of that statement. So we really wanted to know what happened with Hay's car. Why was it so difficult for them to find her car? And so that's why we went down the grass route, which is a really interesting investigation in the film. And you'll have to tune in to the film to see what happens.
And what do you mean by contamination?
Contamination meaning that the police had planted all of this information for Jay to retell it in his various statements, because he made a variety of versions of the events that happened that day, including where he said he saw the body of Heyman Lee, which,
where the car was parked, where they were.
Which is a strange thing for somebody to say, to not remember exactly that spot where they saw that horrible event happen, yeah.
Anand and I weren't really close friends, but we had a ton of mutual friends. And so when someone gets arrested, you start to think of, what's the last time I saw this person? And then you start to think of, when's the last conversation that I had with them? And it popped into my head, like, oh, I remember that day I saw him in the library.
I want to ask you about Asia McClain. She's someone else you feature in the series, and she was the eyewitness who put Anand in the school library at the time that he was supposedly killing Heyman Lee. And here's what she said about talking with Sarah Koenig, the host and producer of Serial.
When I talked to Sarah on the phone, at best, I thought maybe she was going to write an article. Back then, no one knew what a podcast really was. And then to have it go so viral, so quick, it was just a very surreal and sickening experience.
The sickening part, I think, might touch on how she was treated online. What happens to her and other people who are threatened or bullied or questioned post-Serial?
Well, you have to remember that Serial was actually the first podcast that ever went viral like that. So I don't think anyone even knew what a podcast was when they started talking to Sarah. And Asia was trying to offer her statement, which she had recently offered to the defense. And when the podcast went viral, she became a character in a murder case that was hated by many and loved by many. And so suddenly she became a celebrity for something that she thought was just kind of, something that she needed to tell to the defense. And so she wasn't prepared for that level of fame. And there was some really severe hatred for Asia online. And so with me, she waited 2 years to agree to be interviewed. I mean, I had to work so hard to get her to, tell her story, because she just felt like she had no control of her story after the podcast.
What was your offer to her? How did you persuade her to come on?
We would speak, and then she would consider talking to us, and then she would back out. She just needed to feel right. And at a certain point, I think after two different courts of appeals, had granted Adnan a new trial, she decided that this was the time, and she was such an important part of our film.
We're talking with Amy Berg about her documentary series, The Case Against Adnan Syed. I want to ask you about this case in particular. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was featured in a hit podcast, and you have obviously spent some time looking at it for your documentary series. Why is this story and this murder so captivating? What does it say more broadly about the criminal justice system, about class, about race, about age, about policing? What are the bigger themes that you think it illustrates? Because it is certainly a case that has obsessed a lot of people.
Well, you know, they call Baltimore the melting pot of America because it really is kind of a melting pot of many different cultures. And I'll say that when I was interviewing one of the detectives on this case, Detective Massey, I asked him in one of our earlier interviews, I asked him what it was like to investigate or have a case that involves a Korean family. And he just looked at me because it's very difficult because we have a language barrier. And that sentence really struck me because I'm just trying to picture how you investigate when you can't speak the same language. How do you ask questions of the family? I was always concerned with the fact that Hayes' pager records never showed up in this case. And you would think it would be the first thing that the police would request to see where she was. She was a missing person for 3.5 weeks before they found her body. So this case has a lot of culture clashes. It has, Baltimore Police Department is kind of notorious for the way they police. And so I was really interested in all the cultures and how immigrant families were dealing with something on this level.
Were you able to speak to the family of the victim in this?
We didn't actually speak to Hay Minley's mother or brother, but we were able to speak to a representative of the family who was with them at the time, and she spoke to their experience, their concerns, and what she gave us a real context for what they were going through at the time.
Were you able to talk to Adnan Syed?
I spoke to him extensively in prison on the phone. I went and visited him a few times, and I spoke to his family extensively and his advocate, Rabia Chaudhry, a lot of his friends. We actually had been granted access to interview him in the prison, and then 3 days before we went, they canceled it. So the state decided they didn't want to allow us that access. But his voice is very present in the film.
When you were putting this together, you've obviously been working on it for a very long period of time. You have lots of footage, and you're starting to think about the case as you're editing and as you're talking about it now. Right. Does it change in your mind? Because it's one of those things that no matter where you look, you see different things. You can interpret different facts, that it's very hard to pin anybody or any fact down in the story.
Right. I mean, the whole investigation done by the police and the state back in 99 was based on a tip that they received saying you should look at the ex-boyfriend, and they built a whole case around that. There's not a file that shows that they investigated anybody else. There aren't interviews with her boyfriend at the time, with her family, with the people that were closest to her. So you're limited by their tunnel vision. It makes it difficult. It's a tragedy, actually, because if there was a wrongful conviction, then where do you go to start investigating now?
And what was it like for you to make it, to spend time talking to people about something as horrific as the murder of a teenage girl?
Well, it's tough to live in these spaces. I've been in it for 3.5 years, and it's tough. It's just difficult. That's all I can say. Making documentaries is not easy, and this was a tough story, but I feel very passionate about it, and I really want the justice system to work in the right way.
Amy Berg is the director of the documentary series, The Case Against Adnan Syed. Amy, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
And in the wake of Friday's denial of an appeal for Adnan Syed, filmmaker Amy Berg released this statement. This is an unexpected outcome given the clear prior opinions of both lower courts that underscore the need to retry this case. I find the decision disappointing considering all the troubling and lingering questions surrounding this case that we explored while filming. The second episode of The Case Against Adnan Syed debuts March 17th on HBO. Coming up on The Frame, drummer and composer Antonio Sanchez puts a beat to the bad hombre myth. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Antonio Sanchez is perhaps best known for his frenetic drum score for the 2014 Academy Award Best Picture, Birdman. His follow-up album struck a decidedly political chord. In 2017, the jazz drummer and composer released an album called Bad Hombre. It's a direct reference to a term used by Donald Trump during the final presidential debate in 2016 when he referred to undocumented Mexican immigrants in the U.S. as bad hombres. Sanchez performed, produced, and engineered the album, which pairs drum improvisations with electronic elements. Now, for the first time, he and his band will perform the entire album live this week at Cal State Northridge. Let's revisit my interview with Sanchez from 2017 when the album was released. We'll start with his talking about his response to Trump's comments.
This album is like a direct answer to that rhetoric, saying, you know, there's a lot of Mexicans that we live in the States. We contribute to society. We're good people. We're hardworking people. We're creative people. And we're not going anywhere.
So how do you capture that idea narratively? Is it inside the music? Is it in what you're saying, what you're playing? How do you make that come true through the album itself?
It all started from drum improvisations. So when you improvise, the beauty about jazz and improvisation is that you get to play what you are, what you're feeling, what's affecting you, what is going on at that moment. I did, you know, hours upon hours of drum tracks, and this was all while the candidacy of Trump started, and then after the election, when we all knew he was going to be president, I kept on doing that. And then I started editing improvisations and then adding layers of electronics to those improvisations. I started realizing, you know, how much anger I could hear in the music. You know, as an artist, if you don't do stuff that relates to what you're feeling, what's going on in the world, I think you're kind of have your eyes closed and your ears closed as well. That's why it was so influenced by what was going on.
Let's listen to the very, very opening of the album. It's kind of an intro to the title track, Bad Hombre.
Año de 1900 en el 13 que pasó, murió Benito Canales. El gobierno lo mató. Andaba tienda por tienda buscando tinta y papel para escribirle una carta a su querida Isabel.
I don't speak a lot of Spanish. I think I heard something about government in there. What is that guy saying?
Yeah, it's the government killed this guy, Benito Canales. He was going to try to say goodbye to his girlfriend. And he was looking for her, and the government ended up killing him. These are all tales about the Mexican Revolution. That's the voice of my grandfather, Ignacio López Tarso, who was arguably the most famous living, working actor in Mexico. He's 92, doing 8 shows a week of 2 different plays right now. So I really wanted to have something very Mexican in the record. And I thought, okay, mariachi would be great, but what speaks to me? And then I found, I remembered about these tales of the Mexican Revolution that my grandfather used to tell. So it was kind of fortuitous how it all happened.
You say that Bad Hombre is experimental and that it's a complete departure from anything that you've ever done in the past as either a drummer, composer, producer, or even engineer. How do you get yourself in a mindset where you are setting aside everything that you've done before? How do you let yourself be experimental and not follow what you've done previously?
The difference with this album was the creative process, because usually when I'm planning an album, I sit at the piano or the keyboard. I start thinking melody, I start thinking harmony, I start thinking form and rhythm. But in this particular situation, it was all drum improvisations where I'm the most fluid at. So I just kind of let myself go, and that created a completely different vocabulary for me to start adding stuff on. So
I want to play a track that was one of my favorites on the album. It's called Momentum. Let's listen to a little bit of the song Momentum. This This to me almost feels like a little symphony inside a song. There's a little kind of call and response. Other instruments are echoing off what the drums are doing. And then it kind of builds. It has like movements within the song itself. And it lasts 7 minutes. Can you talk a little bit about composing and performing that song?
The way I did this song, like all the backgrounds, all the electronics you hear, there was nothing there. I just did the drums by themselves without listening to anything. And the only goal I had was to start building motifs, ideas. I always like to tell stories when I'm playing or when I'm composing. Storytelling is incredibly important to me. So I was trying to develop something that would make sense, even if you had absolutely nothing else going but the drums. And then my goal was to just speed up. That's it. I was only thinking, okay, build motifs, build ideas, and then start speeding up once you start grooving, and then try to incorporate those ideas into faster ideas. So hence the name Momentum. And then I think what makes this album also interesting is that, you know, I played everything on it. I engineered it. I arranged it. I mean, I did everything because I wanted to see what would happen if I had absolutely no outside influence.
That was drummer and composer Antonio Sanchez, who'll perform his album Bad Hombre March 13th and 14th at the Soraya Theater at Cal State Northridge. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.